Good evening. I'd like to call this meeting to order of our Reedley City Council. We'll have our invocation from Pastor Marlon Hyatt of the Reedley Mennonite Brethren Church, and we'll have our Pledge of Allegiance by Councilman Pete Chavez. Would you all rise with me, please?
Let's pray together. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for this opportunity to come together, and I just thank you for leadership for those who lead our city. Lord, I ask your blessing upon them for guidance, for wisdom. And tonight we thank you for a new member joining, for Bob Beck and for his wife Beverly. Lord, just bless them in their role of serving the community. Lord, we just look to you for guidance, because we know there's no other way for us to give guidance and for our city to be led and guided well if it doesn't come from you, from strength, from knowledge, from wisdom, from above, from on high. Lord, we lift to you our city concerns. And Lord, I know each person here has their set of concerns of what they think are important issues, things that need to be settled, things that need to be worked on. And so, Lord, we bring all of those to you. And we ask that as we are here, Lord, that we would be used in your service to serve you, to serve one another. And then, Lord, to do this well, we recognize we need a strength that goes beyond that of ourself. When we join together, we can accomplish so much more. And when we join together with you in the middle of that, with you as the head of that, then so much more can be accomplished. So come and meet with us here tonight. Lord, be in this place. Lord, in each heart, in each mind, in each spirit, in each will. Just come and have your way and your will. Bring a peace and a unity that will accomplish much. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Everyone, please join the City Council in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
May I have the roll call, please?
Councilmember Betancourt.
Here.
Chavez.
Here.
Salino.
Here.
Mayor Fast.
Here. I'm delighted this evening we have a swearing in ceremony for our new council member, Robert Beck. And I think I'll turn it over to our city clerk to do the honors for that.
The Constitution of the State of California against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California.
That I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
That I take this obligation freely without any mental reservations and purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties upon which I am about to enter.
And that I will faithfully and discharge duties upon which I am about to enter.
I Okay, I think we need to put a nameplate up there for him, please. Thank you. Bob, I don't know if you'd like to make any comments. You're sure welcome to do that at this time.
Well, first, I'd like to thank the council for putting their faith in me and the community. I also would like to thank Nicole for the process she went through and the members that was on that board that sat through it. It was very, very interesting, but it was very refreshing to be at ease with her. I'd like to thank every one of the city staff that I talked to this last week. They were so good to me. They took me around, introduced me back to the city, trying to bring me up to speed. Yeah. And so I really enjoyed that, and I've still got a little bit left to go, but I will be going out again and touching bases with these people. Also, I had an opportunity to be a part of the leadership program with the Greater Chamber of Commerce this week. Valerie allowed me to be a part of their group, and I really want to say that I had a really good time, and you've got a great program going there. Thank you.
Great. Would you like to introduce your family to us?
Well, my wife, Beverly, is sitting there. My son, Robert. My daughter, Tammy. We got my grandson, Corey. His sisters, Erin and Kimberly. My little ones, Maddie and Miranda. Eleanor is here somewhere, my daughter-in-law. There she is. And Uda, who is my friend of my Tammy's here. And I think that, did I miss anyone? Corey. Oh, no, no, Nora. Nora. That's my grandson's girlfriend.
All right. Very important. Well, I just again wanted to say welcome, and I think back to 2006 when I became a member of the council, and Mr. Ikemia at that point was going off the council, Donald, and he brought me a great big bag of nuts in the shell. And he said, this is kind of how it is being on the council. And he gave it to me and walked away. So I didn't have time to go get a big bag of nuts, or I would have done that this evening. Would anyone else on the council like to make any comments?
Welcome aboard, and you'll be my
thank you.
My neighbor here for, okay. for another year.
Good, but we look forward to working with you.
Likewise, Bob.
Good.
You know, known you for a long time. You know what the city's all about, and I think you know what the city needs. So we're looking forward to it.
Glad to be aboard.
All right. Well, we have Sylvia's put together some refreshments for us this evening, so I think we'll take a break at this point and have some refreshments and. Anyone that would like to come up and congratulate? Okay, I'd like to call our meeting back to order. And item two on our agenda is the quarterly crime update report from our police department. Chief?
Good evening, Mayor and council members. Joe Garza, your chief of police. I would like to talk to you this evening about criminal statistics as it pertains to the city of Reedley. Crime stats is one of those issues that can either be good news or bad news. Unfortunately, I cannot tell you whether it's good or bad. That's up to you as a person who's going to be receiving the information. I intend to provide you with factual information for the past 3 months, specifically July 2011 to September of 2011. In addition, you'll also be able to compare the past 3 months to the 3 months prior to that, and also be able to compare it to similar months in 2010. So I'll be able to give you an idea of what it was last year as compared to this year. And so you can see the increases or decreases. This is the first of many presentations that I intend to provide to you in regards to crime statistics. I believe that in order for the city of Reedley to make appropriate decisions, it's important to provide current information. These presentations will be provided to you not only in a quarterly statistical update, but in a yearly view at the close of each calendar year. I have three objectives this evening. One is to provide you with a quick glance at the police department's personnel in 2010 to 2011 fiscal year and compare it to the 2011-2012 fiscal year. Second, to provide you with statistics showing the increase or decrease of crimes in the city of Reedley. And third, to compare the crime rates of Reedley and neighboring cities for 2010.
There we go.
The first slide that you have that's here, and I've also provided to you to view on at the dais. In 2010, 2011, the police department was allocated for 32 sworn officers. If you look at it per capita, taking the total population of approximately 26,000, our officer per capita is 1.23. And again, these numbers are just given to you just as a method of seeing where we are at currently. In 2011-2012 budget, we are allocated 31, which gives us a total officer per capita of 1.19. which is obviously decreased from the previous year. Obviously, that was as a result of budget cuts, et cetera, that we had to make. Currently, we have 27 officers that are currently working for the police department that are out in the field, which actually gives us a total per capita of 1.03. We currently have one inactive officer who's out on injury, and then we have three officers that are in training. Prior to last week, that officer vacancies was equaling one, but I'm happy to report that we were able to hire back one officer that left to the city of Visalia and decided to come back, thought that the grass was a little greener on the other side of the fence, but thought otherwise and came back to us just after being gone for a month and a half. So that when she did leave, we lost some experience, but obviously with her coming back, we gained a tremendous amount of experience. So that's a positive for the city of Reedley. Part one, crimes. I'm proud to announce that the city of Reedley has not experienced a homicide in the past 6 months, but more importantly, we have not experienced a homicide since September of 2010. As you can see, our robberies have had a significant decrease from April 2011 to September of this year. Our assaults, unfortunately, have seen an increase. The leading cause of the reported assaults is a change in law regarding domestic violence. The law used to read that a person who would have to file charges for a suspect to be arrested on domestic... The law used to read that a person would have to file charges for a suspect to be arrested on domestic violence or domestic assault. Now, when a police officer is called to a domestic assault, if there is evidence of an assault, the officer shall make an arrest. No one has to file charges. This is important. This is an important change, and one, I might add, that was extremely needed. It is for the better. Domestic assaults are the most dangerous calls our officers respond to. They are emotionally charged and tense situations. We get the calls from the spouse we investigate, and in a number of cases, we end up being the bad guy in the eyes of the people who called for our help. It is very difficult to police what's going on behind closed doors in someone's home. So that's one crime that's really hard for us to do anything about other than trying to get the education out there for our community. With the growth of population, go to the next screen. Okay, part one, crimes property. With the growth in population that we've seen and the growth that we're continuing to see, as far as new subdivisions, new apartment complexes, businesses, and unemployment rates, when you put it all together, we're keeping theft in general on par. As you can tell, our numbers have not changed significantly for theft. There is no significant increase. However, there is a decrease, especially in burglaries and auto thefts, as you can see. That you will also, again, you will see that the blue bar indicates April to June. The middle bar indicates July to September, and then the green bar indicates July to September of last year. So you can compare from last year to this year the decrease in our burglaries. Our thefts pretty much stayed the same, and our stolen vehicles decreased significantly from last year. Anytime crime doesn't increase by a significant amount, it's a positive, as far as I'm concerned. Part two, crimes, are there just for you to take a look at. These are really hard to gauge as far as what kind of impact they have on crime in the city of Reedley, but they are just there available because that is something that we have to report to the FBI on a monthly basis. And you can see our sex crimes dropped considerably as opposed to last year, and our narcotics cases actually dropped significantly from last year, and our child abuses have dropped also. And again, that's just for your information.
Can I ask a question? The narcotics problem is still higher than we'd like.
Yes, the narcotics problem is still higher than we'd like. We are having some significant impacts with our by utilizing our narcotics canine dog and making some significant finds out there. But it is still a problem that we're trying to deal with. Traffic collision statistics. I'm proud to say that traffic collisions have dropped over 50% since last year, as compared to this year or this time period last year. In this past quarter, our enforcement of traffic violators has proven to be effective. During the period of April to June 2011, we had a traffic officer assigned to deal with primarily with traffic violators. However, since July of 2011, we have not been able to fill that position due to vacancies and needs in other areas. This reduction in service will be evident when we look at case numbers issued in a few slides. In addition, the use of media has contributed to the reduction of collisions. Programs targeting teen drivers, distracted drivers, and intoxicated drivers have all significantly impacted the amount of collisions that we investigate. So that's obviously the media working in our favor and the public adhering to a lot of the information that's being put out there by law enforcement.
Talking about traffic, you know, we have some problems with some of our streets where speed is really bad. Not only neighborhoods, but our major streets. So what can we do to take care of the problem?
Well, a lot of the information there, if we are having problems in particular neighborhoods, what the citizens would have to do is contact the police department so we can do some directed enforcement in that particular area. We try to focus our attention in the mornings around the school areas, you know, especially where the kids are walking to school. So a lot of times that's where we focus a lot of our enforcement. But if there's specific times that it's happening, we would just ask for the public to contact the police department and say, hey, I'd like to have an officer out here during this time, and we can get an officer out there to do some enforcement in that particular area.
Okay. I know that I Street is getting bad. Reed is getting bad again. Neighborhoods in some areas, it's getting bad. And in some areas, people are concerned that, you know, they're going to be asking for a stop sign, but the city always says they have an excuse for not putting stop signs. Okay, so what can we do to remedy that problem?
Well, a lot of it has to be through the Traffic Safety Committee. A lot of that information has to be forwarded through them, and the recommendations have to be made. Now, we can provide statistical information as far as collisions that are occurring in those right. particular areas.
Right. The recommendation would be not to come individually in neighborhoods to complain about it, but to get a neighborhood sign up and complain about it totally. That way they listen to them. But if a person comes in by themselves, nothing happens. So that's what I'm recommending.
Okay.
All right.
Something we can look into. Yes, sir. Yeah. Our traffic collision stats are just kind of broken down into the four areas here. Fatal, obviously, we have not had any fatal traffic collisions. Our injury traffic collisions are pretty steady as compared to last year, and obviously our non-injury traffic accidents have reduced tremendously from last year as compared to last year. Our hit and runs have also stayed pretty steady as compared to last year. Our average calls per day, again, this is just some information that our department handles approximately, currently we are handling approximately 54.2 calls per day. As compared to last year, that we were handling about 60 calls per day. And that's obviously in a 24-hour period, and that can range anywhere from a barking dog complaint to an actual felony crime in progress that we're responding to. Calls for service. This pie chart here shows the actual calls that the public has been initiating to the police department. As you can see, that we have not changed. There has been very little change as compared to last year to this year. Now, what makes it very interesting is if you look at our officer-initiated calls have dropped significantly from last year as compared to last year and as compared to the previous quarter. A lot of this can be attributed to that we have fewer officers that are out in the field, and we're doing fewer officer-initiated calls. However, our public-initiated calls are staying the same. So we're having to respond to calls with less officers as opposed to last year when we had a few more officers out in the field. As I indicated before, the significant decrease in case numbers that you see here, that you see from April to June 2011 to July 2011, we've dropped significantly about 200 case numbers. The reason for that loss is because of the motor officer. Each citation that we issue requires a case number be issued by the officer. And as you can tell, our officer during that time was extremely busy. And that has, and again, that attributes to the fact that that has been a significant decrease, is because we did lose that officer assigned to traffic. And then our total arrest for this quarter is slightly down from last year, but significantly down from the previous 3 months. Now, before we go to the next slide, we all start kind of patting ourselves on the back, or the police department really pats themselves on the back and says we've been doing a good job, and we consider the city of Reedley one of the safest, which I think it is, one of the safest communities in the area. There are some things that we just need to be concerned about as far as what affects crime and the volume of crime, according to the FBI Uniform Crime Reporting, what they see as factors is population density, stability of population, modes of transportation, economic conditions, cultural factors, family conditions, climate, effective strength of law enforcement agencies, the citizens' attitude towards crime, and crime reporting practices of the citizenry. Now, these are all factors that go into place on the amount of type or the type of crimes that we're having in the city of Reedley. Oops, I went too far. Now, this one here, this shows here that the city of Reedley, and these are in order from the least to the most, and you see that the city of Reedley, as compared to similar agencies or similar cities in the area and compared to some of the larger communities in our area, we are ranked number one for the crime rate per 1,000 persons. During the year of 2010, we reported 663 Part 1 crimes, which are homicides, assaults, thefts, etc. And that shows a crime rate of only 27.7 as compared to the city of Selma, which reported 1,500 and has a crime rate of just above 65. So that's meaning that at least 65 people per 1,000 that are victims of a Part 1 crime. So as you can tell, that is fairly significant for the city of Reedley. Again, there are other factors that go into play here as far as what people are reporting and how they're reporting it that paint a picture. So again, we just have to look at those numbers and just take them for what they are. But I'm very proud to say that the city of Reedley is at the top of that list for our area, you know, as compared to some of our neighboring cities, city of Dinuba, city of Sanger, Parlier, so our crime rate is actually really, really good as compared to other agencies, other cities. So that's a good job for us. The job of the police department, our police officers, doesn't stop with law enforcement. We notice things like burned out street lights, potholes, and other things. When we see something like that, we notify the appropriate city department so that repair processes can begin. The way I look at it, we have the people on the streets patrolling, so why not help with the total package? It gets back to what we in the police department want to be part of, and that is a partnership, which is something that Ms. Ziba is really key on. And we're being a partner to the workers in public works, parks and recs, and community development. And in closing, the most important partnership is the one we have with you folks and the folks in the community. And I thank you for your support, the words of encouragement that you have given me and the men and women in the police department. I've been with the department for 21 years now, and I'm proud of the fact that the past 6 months I've been the leader of this department. And I'm proud of the job the Reedley Police Department is doing, but I also know that we couldn't do as good of a job if it weren't for the support that you give us. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'll be available for any questions if you have them.
Okay. Are there any questions from the council? Concerns?
I don't have a question related to the crime statistics, but I do have a question. I saw where they're honoring Officer Wallmeyer.
Yes, sir.
And do we have any plans to honor our officer in the same fashion?
Yes, we are currently in the process of speaking with Leon Isaac from COPS, because he was instrumental in getting the Manning Avenue corridor dedicated to his son when his son died in line of duty back in 96. So we are in contact with him, and so we can find out exactly what the process is and then identify the most appropriate road that we can use to dedicate it to our officer, if that's something that is, if we're able to do.
I know that, you know, I was semi-involved with one when I was with the county, and I know that a lot got done through our assembly person. And so, you know, that would be a good place to start. Contact Mr. Perea and have him do the groundwork. Well, we had Mr. Arambula do a lot of the work for us, so anyway, and I'm certainly here to help also if you need some help.
Well, we do appreciate it, and that's something we've talked about already, and it's something that we, you know, we'll definitely seek any input that we can get to make it happen. I think it's the least we can do to honor our officer.
Great. Thank you, Chief. Public comment provides an opportunity for members of the public to address the City Council on items of interest to the public within the Council's jurisdiction and which are not already on the agenda this evening. It is the policy of the Council not to answer questions impromptu. Concerns or complaints will be referred to the City Manager's office. Speakers should limit their comments to not more than 3 minutes. No more than 10 minutes per issue will be allowed. For items which are on the agenda this evening, members of the public will be provided an opportunity to address the council as each item is brought up for discussion. Is there any public comment this evening?
Yes, there is.
State your name and address for our record.
My name is Ronald Pierce, and my address is 36633 Hawthorne Lane, Squaw Valley. Before I start tonight, I want to include my comments from the previous public meeting on the 11th. This is a continuation of those comments. I'm here for the same issue. And as I start off with this, I want to apologize up front to the Beck family, because you seem like a real nice fella. My mother speaks highly of you. You have a beautiful family, and I don't mean to rain on your parade tonight, but your swearing in is constitutionally defective, because at the last public meeting, I brought to the council's notice that Miss Nicole here never swore in herself. She never took office. Instead, she pretended to fire the city clerk, which means that she's not city clerk, so she can't swear you in. This is called a usurpation of office, and it's illegal, which I did report. I did report to the officer. He's going to let it go. I'm really sorry about this, but it's not, I'm apologizing, but this isn't my fault, okay? You have somebody that, instead of taking the office and swearing in like you did yourself, instead decided to go ahead and fire a couple people before entering office and then make someone else city clerk. Therefore, that action is void too. It's been directly challenged. This is not a de facto officer thing we're talking about here. When it's directly challenged, when that officer who usurps the office doesn't fool the public, there is no authority, and anything they do is void. You can't go back and go, well, they were a de facto officer, so we're, you know, there was some defects to their constitutional qualifications to office. It doesn't work like that. There's been a direct challenge on public record here that this person is not in office, therefore the other person is not in office. And so, sir, I'm sorry. They did not have authority to swear you in tonight. I'm very sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other public comment this evening? Would you please state your name and address for the record?
Okay.
My name is Robert Lewis, 1438 South Riverview Avenue. Mayor, members of the council, ladies and gentlemen, I want to speak briefly tonight about a concern I have as a private citizen regarding a non-governmental organization titled Agenda 21. I have provided a small paper for you. This is what I would call a panic paper. It's designed to make it look as bad as possible, but I also urge you to go on the internet and search this out. This is an agency which desires to control the natural resources in America through the operation of municipal laws and regulations. And it does threaten private property. I don't think that we need to have it here in Reedley. I strongly urge that you inform yourself on this and then reconsider any plans you may have that might involve this kind of regulation. That's as much as I can say about it in a short time. I could talk for a long time, but you'd throw me out, and I hate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Is there any other public comment this evening? Seeing none, we'll move on. The consent agenda. Items are considered routine in nature and voted upon as one item. Under a consent agenda category, a recommended course of action for each item is made. Any council member may remove any item from the consent agenda in order to discuss and/or change the recommended course of action, and the council can approve the remainder of the consent agenda. The council member's vote in favor of the consent agenda is considered and recorded as a separate affirmative vote in favor of each action listed. Motions in favor of the consent agenda are deemed to include a motion to waive the full reading of any ordinance on the consent agenda. For adoption of ordinances, only those that have received unanimous vote upon introduction are considered consent items. Would anyone like to remove the item from our consent agenda?
Move to approve.
Is there a second?
Second.
Call for the question.
Councilmember Cellino.
Yes.
Chavez.
Yes.
Beck.
Yes.
Betancourt.
Yes.
Mayor Fast.
Yes. Item 4 is resolution number 2011-076 under new business, a resolution authorizing the City of Reedley street banner policy and procedures. Mr. Robertson or City Manager?
Didn't mean to bring my soda to the podium.
Sorry. Ms. Communications, staff would like to pull this item from the agenda tonight and bring it back at a later date.
Oh, okay.
Oh. Yes. Thank you.
Okay, we'll mark that one off. Item 5 under workshop is the Downtown Streetscape Committee. I'd like to see you say that 10 times in a row. Oh, man.
Just kidding.
I'll do it.
Mr. Berletic.
Mayor Fast, members of the council, David Berletic, city planner. This item is a workshop, and it's the Streetscape Improvement District. They want to share their five-year improvement plan and talk about their funding. The purpose of the workshop is to share with you the activities that are occurring in the district and let you know things that are coming up in the future, keep you informed of everything that's happening. A little bit of background on the Streetscape District. It was started in 1986. There is a copy of the ordinance and a boundary description with your staff report. It's roughly 9th Street to 13th Street on G Street, including both alleys east and west. And what happens in that district is all the business license holders pay a $16.50 assessment fee that goes into a fund for defined improvements that are listed within the ordinance or in the municipal code. Those funds go towards those improvements, and they also go towards other improvements that are on our five-year improvement plan. They do get a discount if they pay on an annual basis versus every month. If they do that, I believe it's $174 a year instead of $198 a year. The annual revenue is about $24,000, $25,000 a year, and there's an ongoing maintenance and operation cost of about $17,000 to $18,000. That's from a landscape maintenance contract. That's the biggest cost of the downtown, is maintaining the trees and tree wells. So we run a little bit of a a surplus that we build up over a few years and then make some improvements. In order to help see a quicker change in the downtown, in 2010, the Streetscape Committee came before you, before the RDA, Redevelopment Agency, and asked for some assistance. And what you approved was a five-year funding of $25,000 per year to the Streetscape District to fund specific improvements in the five-year plan and those that are also listed in the municipal code. Those funds were put into the fund. They're there now. The Streetscape District has an advisory committee. It's made up of three business owners. They're all here tonight. They are, the chairman is Dale Melville. Eric Parishan and Scott Preheimer here also. And Chairman Melville is going to give you a presentation that the audience can follow along on. You also have a hard copy in your staff report. He's going to give you a presentation on the five-year plan and our current funding situation and the activities that have occurred. We're not asking you to take action tonight. What we'd like you to do is give us some feedback as to whether or not you're in support of the direction we're going and want us to continue doing what we've been doing. Then we'll be available for questions.
Thank you, David. Good evening, Dale.
Good evening. Thank you for the time to give you an update on the five-year program for the Streetscape. On the way over here, I was thinking about Eric and Scott, and they're here to answer all the hard questions, so feel free to throw them at them. But the three businesses that we represent have been in business in Reedley for a combined over 230 years of those three businesses. So it doesn't give us any credibility or anything, but it was just interesting. I was thinking about the experience that's on the committee and their dedication to the city of Reedley. So mine is by marriage, so Pam is the one that gets the credit there. But okay. In February of 2010, we provided to the yourselves sitting as the redevelopment agency a five-year plan that we were planning to move ahead with. We came to the redevelopment agency with a request for some funding that David just talked about, that you gave in to the Streetscape Committee in the order of $25,000 a year. We definitely appreciate, and the first thing I want to do is say thank you very much. It's making an impact downtown. So with that, let's see. There we go. Before the redevelopment funding, we did have some benches, a sound system. Through our funding, I'd put some potted plants on the corners years ago, and with the assistance of the Public Works Department, got signposts painted. But we didn't have the money to do some of the heavy lifting. And in addition to the $5,000 or so that we were able to generate for capital improvements, your $25,000 has allowed us to move forward with replacement of a lot of the trees. We were having different problems with trees. We're trying to now go pretty much with the Chinese pistache and get some uniformity and trees that don't have the tendency for aphids and uplifting sidewalks and roots and things like that. I think this will be a good solid tree for us in the future and help get that canopy look that we're trying to get in the downtown area. That part of that is getting some larger tree wells. We've been able to do some bike racks, and you can read the list of things that we've been able to do since your funding just over the last year and a half. And we have some more things proposed, and we'll talk about those a little bit more also. You can't read this. Hopefully David's provided you. Whoops, there it comes. In fact, if I could get one too, I don't have a late one, Sylvia. This gets pretty small to read, and that's why we've got a handout for you. I just want to run through real quickly. Those in the audience can't see what's there, but I want to highlight a few things. What we're doing is comparing. Let's see, is there a little laser here? Let's see if that's
pass
it.
Pass these out. Yeah. If if anybody wants one.
If you look at the column, it's a February 2010. This was the budget that we brought forward at that time and the costs involved. We've now updated that in this October 2011 block here. And then we'd look at the difference in costs and some of the maintenance involved. The key items here, though, are we've moved ahead and completed some of the upgrades to the sound system. We've got planted about 120 new trees in the downtown area, taking out some of them that had some of the problems that we talked about, either because of the species or other problems to the particular trees. There's been some added benches. We'll talk about that in a little more detail. One of the main things, though, is tree grades. That under this previous budget, our previous by meaning the February 2010 budget, we were estimating it would be about $800 per tree well to add metal tree grates around the tree wells. Since then, we found that in talking with City of Visalia, as well as I've talked to also City Modesto, you might be able to get the grate for that much, but by the time you make all the other improvements to get so that the grate will fit and the concrete improvements associated with it and labor, it runs just about $2,000 a tree well. Mm-hmm. And that got a little bit more expensive than what we had appetite for budget. Mm-hmm. But some of the things that we have done, we've got some new benches. The committee decided to subsidize the cost of benches 50%, so up to, I think it was about 10 benches. So far we've got five people that or businesses that have asked for new benches, and we've got those recently installed, and still room for some more. Again, we've got over 120 new trees that we've placed downtown, and they're pretty obvious because there's not much shade they're producing right now, but they will be. One of the big improvements, kind of in the historic look, is coming up with a new trash can design. Some of the older cans are still out there. Not all the new cans are out there, but we purchased 31 new cans. Appreciate your funding and being able to do that. And we've added both, it has both the recycle as well as trash containers, which we coordinated with the City of Reedley and the department heads to come up with that that type of a system. Three things I really want to focus on now is the tree wells, our request to move from grates to bricks, or at least our explanation of why we are proposing that. I want to talk about the collection of delinquent streetscape fees. We have some businesses that don't pay that fee, and it decreases our revenue and adds to our costs. And I'll give you some other ideas of some of the future things that we'd like to see in the downtown area. Tree wells, this one is generally what we'd like to be able to do with the tree wells. Right now there's just a empty tree well. We'd like to widen them more and put bricks around them. This is the alternative to the metal grates. It's ADA compliant. It kind of complements what we already have downtown in terms of the brick motif through the sidewalks and kind of that historic look. Fits well. The nice thing about the bricks is that they're very flexible, so that as the tree grows, we can remove a row of brick. If there's some uplifting, it's a lot easier to replace and reset brick than it is to have to cut back sidewalks. So our program is to cut the sidewalk tree wells larger and brick them in. Whoops. Let's see if I can go backwards there. Oops. Okay. A little too far. Get the touchdown here pretty soon. This is some of the problems with some of the larger trees in a small tree well. You can see on the right the brick lifting up. Sidewalks do the same thing. I could have easily showed some examples of the sidewalk lifting up, although the City Public Works has been pretty good on staying on top of those. And on the left, you can see where it's actually bulging the curb out, and those situations can get worse. We've gotten a lot of input from the City of Visalia, who's had a very aggressive tree planting program downtown, and gotten a lot of input from them that's helping us size larger tree wells, et cetera. This is kind of what we'd like to see in the downtown area as far as size of the tree well. It's about at least twice the size of what we have right now, and ideally with our program we'd be able to brick most of that in at this with the is what we're proposing to do on the tree wells. So that's the direction we're heading there. Next issue is we all run into budget problems these days. The municipal code that the city has talks about that before business licenses are issued, they need to be current on other payment of other charges and basically in compliance with all the building codes and zoning ordinances and applicable codes that the city has. The interpretation that we've been getting from through planning staff is that both planning staff and legal counsel interpretation is that the city charges must be current before issuing new business licenses. And unfortunately for the Streetscape Committee, over 10 years ago, there was a informal directive by the city manager at that time to not to hold off business licenses if a business is not current on their streetscape charges. May have applied to other charges, I'm not too sure. But that's ended up with a lost revenue to Streetscape District of about 5% of our budget. Our budget's about $23,000 a year, so it's in the order of $1,000 a year. And more importantly, I think, is the principle of it. It's difficult for us to look at other members that are paying their dues and paying their assessments and knowing that others aren't paying it. And it's just a matter of equity is a concern to us. And so we are asking the city manager, since it was never a council action that moved it, or staff, to reinstate enforcement of the city ordinance and not issue new business licenses unless someone is current on their city charges. It just doesn't make sense. If someone wasn't paying their water bill, you don't go issue them a new business license. I think the same thing should apply to the streetscape funding. Briefly, I'll just run by some of the things we'd like to see in the future. Bulb outs at intersections. These are obviously more expensive items. They're not on the within the budget that we have right now, but with the help of Mr. Beletic and others in the city, we're trying to keep our eyes out for potential grant funding or other programs where we might be able to do some cost sharing to make the downtown a little bit more aesthetically pleasing. Bulb outs have also a way of slowing down traffic, which is generally a good thing in the downtown, especially in intersections. Another view of a Visalia bulb out. Mid-block crossings. This is one in Visalia, pretty low-cost crossing in this situation here. It does take up 1 to 2 parking spaces, depending on how you do it, but that's kind of a quick one. This one is one that I took up in Ripon. a little bit more elaborate. Still only, I think this one only took out about one parking spot the way they had theirs oriented there. A little bit nicer pavement. We think that between 10th and 11th and 11th and 12th would be ideal spots for some mid-block crossings, make it a little bit easier for people to get around from to their car or to a business, and make the downtown a little bit more walkable environment there. And that's the presentation for today, just giving you an update and the things that are on our mind, both in the past and the future. But again, want to thank you for the funding that you've given us. It's allowed us to do a lot of these efforts. And so questions are all going to be directed towards Eric and Scott, but you can ask me and I can tell which one of them is going to answer it for you there.
Thank you, Dale, for your presentation. I do have just maybe a couple of comments. I have a lot of people that I meet that either are from Reedley or come to visit Reedley, and mm-hmm. I just want to commend you for the work that all of you have done in the downtown area. Mm-hmm. Always getting comments, Reedley's so nice. I wished our community looked like this.
Yeah. So, and a lot of that, I have to say, Russ Robertson and his crew have done a tremendous job working very closely with us, same as planning when Rob Terry was here and Dave Briletic. Very helpful. It's been a great relationship between our committee and the staff, and we appreciate you making them available to us because they're the ones that the rest of us don't do very much heavy lifting. So. Although we are looking at potentially some getting some volunteers to paint the bottom section of some of the street lights black. The work that Public Works did by painting the signal posts black and all the signposts mm-hmm. downtown, mm-hmm. I think really classed up the look of the downtown. Mm-hmm. And we want to be able to extend that, but we realize there's budget limitations on how much time they have available. But
One other comment I had, I know Ron Nishinaka is working with Tree Fresno, mm-hmm. and I don't know if that might be an opportunity to get trees should you need further trees in the future.
We worked real close when Susan Stiltz was the tree coordinator for Tree Fresno. This is going back probably 10 years ago and worked with them a lot. And on the Rails to Trails work, I work a lot with them. Every time we have we're having tree plantings and we get Tree Fresno involved, they've been a good partner on a lot of programs.
Great. Okay. Any comments from the council? Questions?
Just one question. Do you foresee in the future years you're going to expand your boundaries of the downtown?
It hasn't been something that we've been talking about, but if there's interest, Dave may have some more ideas on that, just as far as, you know, the downtown core and the zoning and things, but it hasn't been something we've talked about. Right. We sure wouldn't object to it if people wanted to participate. I think the larger you could go, the more appealing it whole makes the whole area. Great. Actually, one last comment. Steve Loeffler is the fellow that does a lot of the day-to-day maintenance and the pruning the trees and taking care of the trees and blowing sidewalks and stuff. And he's not here tonight, but I want to give him a kudos for doing a good job and keeping costs down over the years. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Item 6 is another workshop this evening. And this is the Brown Act review and training. And I will turn it over to our city attorney, Scott Cross.
I know he's going to sabotage this one. Let's see. Oh, there we go. Let's see. All right. Good evening, Council. I get to step down on this side. So let me know if I'm talking too loud. This is a perfect opportunity with Councilman Beck being appointed tonight. And then some of the questions that I've gotten even over the last couple of months from some of the council members, just on some general Brown Act stuff, and also staff, to have staff here as well, just to do kind of a quick overview and kind of review. This isn't meant to be an exhaustive review, so certainly feel free to ask me questions as they come up. At the end, we'll also touch on just some of the general conflict of interest stuff. Again, some things that have come up even in the last few months or the last year, just issues that have come up in Reedley in particular, just to kind of highlight some of those things. And with respect to the conflict of interest stuff, it's really, again, as I've said before to probably each one of you, it's not meant to do anything other than to get you guys to think when the issues come up and to get you to say, I might have a conflict here. Let me check with someone else. So just to know that the issue is out there and that you need to double check to make sure if a conflict comes up. So I just want you to be able to recognize the issues. So, but I've got some questions in here, some Q&A stuff, but feel free to ask questions as we go along. But I do have some examples that I'll ask you guys questions to see how good you guys are at Brown Act review. So
May I open it also up to our group
sure.
that's here if there are questions along
sure,
the way,
I think,
if you would just speak up and address Scott on those issues.
Yeah, and the questions will be up there, so we'll make it interactive to the extent we can.
Okay.
So
thank you.
As you guys all know, the Brown Act is California's open meeting law, and it specifies that all meetings of the city council or any legislative body, whether it's school districts or other local agencies and districts, have to be open to the public, except for certain authorized closed sessions. So it applies to even subcommittees and commissions, like the Planning Commission, obviously. The other commissions that are set up by the city are also Brown Act committees, except there's certain exceptions for ad hoc advisory committees that are made up of just less than a quorum of the city council. So it's difficult to imagine what that would be, but basically it would have to be a committee of two council members. So less than a quorum and nobody else. So two council members, nobody else. So those don't come up very often. Otherwise, it's subject to the Brown Act. The first question when it comes up is, you know, what is a meeting basically? Any congregation of a majority of the members of the city council meeting at the same time to hear, discuss, or deliberate on city business, that's going to constitute a meeting. We've got some examples later on about what, you know, the five of you can be at a certain place at a certain time, and it's not going to constitute a meeting. So basically the key is to hear, discuss, or deliberate on matters of city business. So what's not a meeting under the Brown Act? Individual contact. Again, we're talking two council members here, so two does not constitute a majority. So one of you talking to the other is not going to be a Brown Act violation, even if it is discussing city business. And again, we don't advise that. I'd let you guys know I don't even want two of you talking about city business, but frankly, it's not a Brown Act violation if the mayor and Ray are talking about some issue. We don't encourage it, but it's not a Brown Act violation, as long as you don't get a third member involved. So public conferences are not Brown Act violation.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
If two of us discuss an issue, but one is not asking for support to support an issue, that's not a violation.
No, not at all.
No.
Not at all.
But you can discuss an issue.
You can discuss an issue.
As long as you don't make a decision.
Technically speaking, you could even try and get the mayor, convince the mayor of your position is right. Again, I don't encourage it.
No.
And as long as it's only between you two, it is not a Brown Act violation, as long as you're not getting a third member or a majority involved or communicating to a third member. And we'll get into the serial meeting things
right
later, but if Councilman Solano, if you're calling the mayor and saying, I'm going to vote this way on this, I want you to vote the same way, and then next you call Councilman Chavez and tell him, I'm voting this way on this, and the mayor told me she's voting this way on this,
that's a Brown Act violation.
Right.
So you're getting into trouble there, even though, again, you're only having a conversation with the mayor, and then you are only having a conversation with Councilman Chavez. If you're relaying information that another council member is going to do, it's a Brown Act violation. That's why it's a slippery slope to even have two of you talking about it.
But if two council members sit with staff and discuss an issue, is that a Brown Act?
No, not right. If it's only two of you. And again, exactly. You don't include a third person, even after the meeting, and say, hey, we talked to staff about this. This is how the mayor and I are looking to vote. We'd want your support on that. Right. Again, that's going to be a violation then.
Okay. What about emails?
Emails, again, same thing. If we've got emails of all five of you, or even three or four of you, more than a majority, and you're talking about an issue that's going to be coming up maybe on an upcoming city council meeting, that can be a Brown Act violation. It can happen any time where you're talking, even if it's text messaging, emails, whatever. So we need to be careful with that, obviously. So community meetings, other local agency meetings, maybe the majority of you are going to go to the County Board of Supervisors meeting on a specific issue. Again, you can sit there during the Board of Supervisors meeting and even listen, even if it's a specific Reedley topic that they might be discussing, you know, some road project is going through that the county's looking at funding, and it's going to go through Reedley. As long as you guys are not deliberating, if some other agency's deliberating, it's not a Brown Act violation for the three or more of you to be there.
To come and to listen, but sure. If we participated,
you could participate in the discussion again. Okay. as long as it's with respect to the whatever the discussion of the Board of Supervisors or whatever,
okay,
whatever other agency is discussing it. Social gatherings obviously is not going to constitute a meeting under the Brown Act. Staff meetings, if it's strictly just staff, they're not subject to the Brown Act. It's the legislative body, the city council, that's subject to the Brown Act. And then standing committees. Again, the key issue is in any of those contexts, if you just look at it, not going to be a meeting. But again, if everyone shows up at a social gathering, or three of you show up at a social gathering, and then the three of you start talking about matters of city concern, then it's a Brown Act violation. But as long as you're not talking about city matters, you're fine. So, any questions? So regular meetings, the 72-hour posting of the agenda requirement that you guys are all familiar with. Weekend hours count. So again, typically I think the city clerk will post on either Thursday or Friday. So in advance of the Tuesday meeting, meets the 72-hour requirement, we're fine. So for special meetings, they can be called at any time. Typically, it's the mayor that has the authority to call the special meeting. Special meetings only require 24-hour advance notice. And again, they're limited to only whatever the specific issue is that's going to be on the special meeting agenda. There's a little bit more strict interpretation on what can happen. I think I've got a slide in a little bit here, but for regular council meetings, you can add items on the agenda that may come up. For special meeting agendas, you shouldn't add anything at all other than what's already on the agenda. The other issue too that comes up every once in a while is the opportunity for public comment. There's two types of public comments. There's the one general public comment at the beginning of the meeting where it's on the agenda. Everyone has 3 minutes. 3 minutes to talk about whatever it is you want. That's the general public comment period. But then on each individual item on the agenda, the public has a right to comment on that specific item on the agenda before any action is taken. So it can be done during the deliberations or even at the beginning. I think typically the mayor will do it after the council has asked their questions and the staff has given their report, and then obviously open it up to anyone from the public that might want to comment on it before any action is taken. So two types of public comment. The special meeting, there's no requirement that you have the general public comment 3 minute period at a special meeting. It's only required for regular meetings. But again, even on a special meeting, whatever item is on that agenda for that special meeting, even if it's a closed session item, you have to open it up
before you go into closed session or before you do any deliberations on that specific item for public comment on that specific item. Any questions on that? There's a third type of meeting, emergency meeting. We haven't done any of those here. This is an exception to the special meeting 24-hour requirement, and they're really rare, obviously. You're talking about, you know, a terrorist act or a severe threat to public health or safety. You're required under the Brown Act to try and give as much advance notice as you can. But I think one hour for the media, that's all you're required to do. Try and give the media at least 1 hour notice, and then you have to post minutes and then list anyone who's there for at least 10 days. Hopefully we don't ever have to have any emergency meetings. So the conduct of the meeting, Reedley has rules, actually rules of decorum in the municipal code, and most agencies do. But basically the rule is, as long as it's not disruptive, you got to allow them to speak. So basically you have a right to control the meetings, but it's basically disruption only that you can prohibit. You can put reasonable time, place, and manner limitations on public comment like we have with the 3-minute rule. That's considered reasonable. Everyone gets 3 minutes, and then that's it. Disruption is a very fact-specific analysis, and the courts are pretty liberal with disruption, and even just recently there's been some questions about that. But basically someone can come into a meeting and say something that they might otherwise get in trouble saying on the sidewalk. You know, someone could come into a meeting and say something absolutely 100% false, defamatory, you know, a personal attack against the council or any staff member, and we can't shut them down, basically, as long as they're not disrupting the meeting. But again, if someone said something like that on the sidewalk, whoever they were making the personal attack against, if it was defamatory, they could be sued for defamation. But again, in a public meeting, you can't shut them down unless it's causing an actual disruption. So again, someone just coming up and speaking, making statements, it's not going to be a disruption of the meeting. So, but once the 3 minutes is up, if they refuse to sit down and be quiet, then they could be asked to leave. So any questions on that?
And how much authority does the mayor have on that?
Well, again, typically I'm going to, depending on how it's going, I mean, I may make eye contact with her, but and if we know it's coming maybe before the meeting, usually she and I will talk, and I'll let her know. Let them talk or whoever it is. But again, the standard for disruption is pretty high. It's got to be the person is refusing to let the meeting go forward, basically. Again, if they come up, make whatever outlandish statements they might want to make during their 3 minutes, they're done, sit down, we'll continue on with the meeting. It's not a disruption. So, okay. Recording and broadcasting meetings. We record our meetings here. We don't yet broadcast them, but we may, who knows. But they are recorded. But they have, they are a public record. Those recordings are a public record, as well as the minutes, obviously, that are taken. You can't prohibit the recording or broadcasting unless, again, it makes for a disruption of the meeting. If it becomes disruptive, then you can stop the recording and ask them to stop. Any questions on that? So we got just kind of a review. 72 hours for the posting of the agenda, 24 hours for a special meeting. The agenda, as you know, just a brief description of each item. It's got to be enough to notify the public of what it is that's going to be discussed, whether there's going to be action taken, or whether it's just going to be a discussion or like this, a workshop where no action is going to be taken. Got to be unambiguous language so anyone can understand. Time and location of the meeting is always at the top. Got to be posted in a public location and made available in alternative formats if requested. And as each of you know, you can't discuss or take action on an item not on the posted agenda. There are some limited exceptions that we talked about earlier, an emergency situation. Emergency, again, hasn't come up here where we have a regular, let's say we have a regular meeting agenda, and at the last minute we want to add an item to the agenda. We've done that before under a subsequent need item, and the subsequent need item is easier than an emergency situation. It's basically something that comes to our attention since the agenda was posted, like so within the last 72 hours. You know what? This came up, and we need to have the council take action on this tonight. Mm-hmm. So what a subsequent need item would require is a two-thirds vote from the council, two-thirds vote from the council to add that item onto the agenda. And I will advise, if I'm aware of it, I'll advise the mayor and say, hey, this is an item that we might want to add on tonight. Two-thirds vote of the council to add it on, and then now it's added on the agenda, and then just the normal process of taking it in line with the other agenda items if you want to approve it. So again, it's a two-step process. First, you got to add it onto the agenda, then you got to do the discussion and take action on it, whatever it might be. Held over items are pretty rare. Just the timing of the Reedley Council meetings don't really allow for it. A held over item is an item that, let's say tonight, there was an item held over. Well, if you're going to have another meeting within the next 5 days, then you don't have to put it on that agenda. You can actually hold it over and then take care of it. But again, we typically don't have meetings within 5 days of each other. So even if it's continued to the next meeting, we're going to put it back on the agenda, you know, for the next meeting. The emergency situation I touched on, it's really rare. It's basically a work stoppage, a crippling disaster, mass destruction, terrorist or a threatened terrorist act, something like that that you know, need to add on the agenda. Documents, as you all know, any documents that are part of the council packet are all public records, and they need to be available and certainly available upon request. There are certain times where items might be prepared within that 72-hour window, so the agenda's posted, the packet's gone out, and then there might be a late addition to the council packet. Again, those items are all public records as well. They might be available up on the dais. Typically, we try and make copies available for the public as well, but those are all public records. So I think those are posted on the website. Is the agenda posted in the the entire packet's on the website before the meeting? Yeah. So public input, a little bit more on that. You have to provide the time for public input, and again, we're talking here about that 3-minute public comment period. You got to give everyone their 3 minutes if they want it, basically. So, and then the two kinds we talked about, a regular meeting, the general public comment period, which is typically at the beginning of the meeting, the 3 minutes, and then at every meeting, whether a general meeting, a regular meeting, or a special meeting, you have to allow the public to comment on a specific item on the agenda before any action is taken. Just a slide on reasons why people might be speaking. The response, just like on the Reedley agenda, typically, I think everybody knows, you know, the council is generally advised not to respond to public comment, to the general 3-minute public comment period. It's not really a good idea to get in a long-winded debate with people at public comment, and the Brown Act doesn't even really allow for it. You can briefly respond to statements made or ask questions for clarification, which I think has happened in the rare instance. You can obviously request staff to report back or direct staff to handle the issue, or, you know, that might be an item we want to address at a future council meeting. Let's place it on the next agenda. Those are all appropriate responses. You can't prohibit the public from criticizing the city or its employees. We touched on that earlier. So again, the standard is disruption, basically. As long as they're not disrupting the actual orderly meeting, they get their 3 minutes to say whatever they want, basically.
Scott, real quick, can you address the mayor's ability to limit the time in total for public comment?
Yeah, if you've got, depending on what the issue might, I mean, if it's a big issue And I'm trying to think what we may have had. We had an issue, I think, last year, maybe a little more than that, where there was a lot of people in the public that were talking about public safety. I think there was a beating or something that had happened, or someone had gotten stabbed. And so there was a large number of people that had come forward asking for more cops on the street, that sort of thing. That certainly didn't go over, and it's an issue of, you know, great importance for the city. But there can be limits. If it's going to get repetitive, you can limit, as long as it's limited equally, basically, and you let people know, hey, we understand everyone's here to talk about this issue. You know, we've heard from a number of people already. Is there anyone that also wants to speak on this? Is it going to be anything new that's going to be added? Or if there's people that want to talk about other issues, give them the opportunity to speak as well. Is that what you were talking about?
Right, yeah. Right. That if we have a large number, as long as the equal time, so you could, for instance, limit it to 2 minutes each, as long as everyone is given the same amount of time.
Oh, I see. Well, that's for public comment as well, but that's even also on the, it can get confusing, even on the second type of public comment, when you're getting on each individual item as well. Mm-hmm. Again, if you have a specific item on the agenda that now you're discussing, you can even limit that as well, as long as you give equal time to both sides. So again, you shouldn't let, you know, if it's clear there's 10 people that are going to speak in support of some particular issue and only, you know, well, let's say it's 10 and 10. You know, there's the crowd split, half and half want to speak for or against it. You can't let one side get an hour and then limit it to one person speaking against it for 5 minutes and say, okay, we're ready to make our decision and call for a motion. So equal time for both sides of the debate, basically, is what's required. Is there a hand up? Nope.
Is there a total time for topic?
Not on the general. On the regular public comment, yes, we can limit it. 3 minutes, I think, was it 3 minutes? Ten minutes?
Mm-hmm. Total.
But on a specific agenda item, there shouldn't be, unless it starts getting out of hand, and again, it starts getting repetitive, then the mayor can say, okay, we've heard the same thing from five different people. Unless someone had something new to add, we're going to let the other side speak at this point. So you can limit it. Again, if it starts getting repetitive and it's going to be long-winded and they're not really adding anything to the debate or the council's consideration of the item, then the mayor can step in and say, okay, anyone have anything new to add?
Scott,
so
can I give my time to somebody else? Not speak personally, but if I wanted Russ to continue going, so I give him my 3 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, typically, it's really up to the mayor, but I mean, I would say it's no big deal. You know, it's still going to be the same amount of time, whether you know, someone gets up and speaks for his three and then someone else gets up for their three. You know, I think typically you just let it go. And we've had an instance, I know, in Reedley, and I've seen it in other cities, where someone gets up and they may have a speech impediment and they ask for more time. Just give it to them. You know, it's not worth the hassle of, no, you only have 3 minutes, and then they're going to complain. And so just give them the extra time.
They do it in Washington, so we're not here.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
That's why I was asking.
Yeah.
If it's lopsided support, where there are 20 people speaking in favor and one speaking against, they each get their 3 minutes total time, whatever it is. That doesn't mean that one person's going to get more time to talk about.
No, well, and I think you might be talking about just the general, the 3 minute public comment portion, or are you talking about now we're in consideration of a specific item? Public hearing, specific item. You don't have to, if it's clear that there's more people speaking on one side than the other, you don't have to leave the public hearing open just so the other side has the actual 15 minutes that the other side had spoken for. If it's clear that there's no one else wanting to speak on that item, then that's it. Even if they haven't had technically as much time as the other side. So you basically just let the conversation flow as it's going to go, you know, unless it starts getting out of hand and, again, repetitive, they're not adding anything to the council's consideration, then, you know, we can see about asking them, okay, if there's nothing new, you know, we'll ask that people on the other side of the debate would speak up.
I think we just need to be considerate and, you know, it takes a lot of effort sometimes a lot of courage to get up there and speak, and I think we need to let people talk.
Yeah, I think typically you guys do. If not every single time, I don't recall one meeting where I've been to that we've had to shut anybody down, so, or shorten a conversation at all. So,
at the beginning of the meeting, can you ask how many people are kind of for this or against it, and then say that at the time that, you know, because of time limits, you choose five people instead of 20 on this one, or no?
You could. There's nothing that prohibits it. Mm-hmm. I would rather see how the conversation is going to flow beforehand, just to kind of see. I mean, you may, again, at the beginning of the meeting, you may have 10 people that say, hey, I'm ready to talk. You know, I want to get my voice heard here. But then after two or three people speak, and they're like, they're saying the same thing I'm going to say. I'm not even going to get up now. So you don't really know. At the beginning of the meeting, you may have a bunch of people that are gung-ho to talk, and then once it gets to that item, they're not going to want to do it anymore. So I prefer to see how the conversation flows. Let's see if it's going to get overly repetitive, and then at that point, then we'll ask, okay, how many more people are here to speak on that, on this topic and this particular point? Okay, are you going to add anything new? No. Do you really want to speak? No, I'm not going to add anything new. That's fine. And then move on. I don't like to do it at the beginning of the meeting because I don't even want to limit it or have the appearance that we're going to limit it at the beginning of the meeting. Any other questions? Sure. For the consent agenda description?
Very seldom anybody takes the time to read that.
Yeah. I typically like to see, we wouldn't have to have it on every meeting, technically speaking, but there are instances where, like for instance, an ordinance, technically the law requires that an ordinance be read in full. So even if it's like a 10-page ordinance, you got to read it in full unless there's a motion to waive the full reading of the ordinance. So that's why we'll have that language in there. So it's sometimes the council or I might forget, hey, make a motion to waive the full reading. Otherwise, technically, we got to read the full ordinance. Otherwise, it's not valid. Oh, I see.
The detail. Yeah, the detail behind it.
Yeah.
They don't?
I like to have that public comment thing because then it notifies the public. Basically, they know going in, you're not going to respond. You know, it says that in the thing that, you know, it's the council's policy not to respond to questions. We'll refer to city staff.
And it kind of gives guidelines, too. If somebody's never been to, I mean, for me, it's repetitive, and I hate reading that because I, you know, but if you were here for the first time and you wanted to have public comment, how would you know when it was your time if you don't kind of explain it? And that's, to me, that section needs to be said as an explanation.
I like to have it read for that reason alone, just so people know kind of the ground rules going in. They know they got 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Try and limit it to 10 minutes, although, you know, oftentimes it'll go over the 10, but, and that's fine. You know, you guys have the authority to, again, if it's a matter of importance to the city, to let that discussion go and have mm-hmm. 5 or 10 speakers speak mm-hmm. their 3 minutes on it. That's fine. Closed sessions. There's certain times, obviously, where closed sessions are permitted by the Brown Act, and they're spelled out in the Brown Act. Unless it's spelled out in the Brown Act, then it's got to be open session. So there's very limited circumstances. Cities and agencies get in trouble if you just go into closed session. I don't want to go into closed session and talk about it. No, you can't do it. It's got to be on the agenda. It's got to be agendized, and it's got to be announced, put on the agenda in open session. And again, you've got to allow the public to comment on whatever that specific item is on the closed session. Let's say it's real property negotiations. It's on the agenda as real property negotiations. Before the council adjourns into closed session, anyone from the public has a right to comment on, hey, I see the address on here. I don't know what you guys are going to talk about, but the city shouldn't buy that piece of property, whatever it might be. Maybe we're not even talking about buying it. Who knows? But they have a right to comment on whatever that agenda item is before you go into closed session. And then obviously, who's in the closed session? The council and necessary support staff is going to be in there. There shouldn't be anybody in closed session that's not required to be there to provide information to the council. And then you've got to report out. There are certain times where you have to report out. Typically, I'll do the reporting out. It doesn't really matter. It can be either the mayor, the city attorney, the city manager, whoever it is. I know the mayor typically likes to have me report out, which is fine. When action's taken in closed session, you have to report out. If it's simply direction given to staff or legal counsel, there's no requirement to report out what that direction is at this point because there's been no final action. The Brown Act only requires once the action is taken that it be reported out. So approval of an agreement or approval of initiating litigation against someone or approval of a settlement agreement, that sort of thing would have to be reported out. But if you're just giving direction to the city attorney or to staff to do something that's not a final action, then no reporting out is required other than to say direction to staff was given. That was it. Any questions? The permissible closed sessions, I think most of you typically are aware. Real property negotiations is one we typically have. Labor negotiations is another. Pending or anticipated litigation, conference with legal counsel to receive information and to give direction. And then to consider the appointment, employment, evaluation of any public employee that the city council has appointing authority over. So obviously with the city manager, we had a number of closed sessions when we were hiring a new city manager. So that's absolutely permissible. Information acquired in closed session is confidential. You all know that. Any communication made in closed session that specifically relates to the reason for the closed session is confidential and cannot be. It's prohibited from being disclosed by the Brown Act. There's certain penalties for violations. Under Government Code 54963, the city itself can seek injunctive relief if they learn that there is a staff member who may have been in closed session or even one of the city council members is disclosing things from closed session. The city can seek an injunction to have the court order that person to stop. If it's an employee, you can discipline the employee. Obviously, you can't discipline a council member, but you could censure the council member if it's a council member that's doing it. And then obviously referring the council member to the grand jury is another thing. And sometimes you'll see that actually in some of the Southern California cities. I've seen a couple where there's a lot of fighting on the council. Luckily, that doesn't happen here in Reedley. So that's good.
Well, let me ask you a question since you're talking about something as far as a penalty. What if three council members have an item on the agenda and they make a decision outside the council before coming to a meeting? What kind of penalty is assessed to the council members? Or is there any penalty?
Well, the violation of the Brown Act, I mean, there's any number of things that can be done. If it's learned, obviously, number one, you're talking about just a general three of you decide on something before going into the meeting.
If it's an important item and three council members make a decision outside council before they come in and make the decision here, is there a penalty?
Well, the action is invalid technically.
Okay.
But again, someone's got to learn of it to know that the three of you made that decision beforehand and then now came into the meeting and made that decision again on the record. So the decision technically is invalid because done outside.
I'm saying that because it happened once before years ago. Okay. But there was no penalty.
Yeah, you could. I mean, the DA has the authority to prosecute it as a Brown Act violation, as a misdemeanor. But that's you rarely see that sort of thing. Right. It can get referred to the district attorney's office. You rarely see it. to get to that point. But technically, the action, whatever action that was taken in the meeting then, because again, even if you guys are talking about it out of the meeting, it doesn't have any validity unless it's done here.
Right.
So once you do it here, but what you do here is based on conversations you had outside with three of you, technically the decision's invalid.
Okay, so that's what it was. Because it happened here, so it was invalid then.
Should be invalid. Again, if it if it comes to someone's attention, if the three of you keep quiet and no one ever learns, then frankly no one's ever going to know. But if it's discovered, it's a Brown Act violation.
And it was mentioned at a council meeting.
Oh.
Well.
Wow. So I think the base answer he gave you is it can be prosecuted as a misdemeanor.
Yes.
All right. Just want to make sure that what it is. Okay. Good.
So again, just kind of to review member communications, discussion of agency issues outside of a council meeting, again, outside of here, by a majority of the members violates the Brown Act. And Mayor, what you had talked about, email communications.
By the way, Scott, if I can just make sure to be clear, staff briefing to all council members individually is not considered a Brown Act violation as long as we're clear that we are only briefing the council. We're not asking for their opinions. Right. They're not offering what they're going to vote, anything like that. So if you have, let's say, a public works director or a police chief go to brief you each on an issue, that is acceptable under the Brown Act.
So. That's absolutely correct. So we talked about the serial meetings, the intermediaries. You can't use technology. Obviously, we briefly touched on that. The emails, text messages, telephone calls, whatever. I mean, you can't do it. Again, and it's not just the fact that three or four or five of you are together in one setting or emailing each other. It can happen in a serial nature. We got two types, basically. The linear meeting, A phones B, B phones C, C phones D, and at each step, A is telling B, hey, this is the way I'm going to vote on this. B then calls C, B says, I'm voting this way, and A told me they're voting this way. Now you're getting into a Brown Act violation. Again, you're only talking one-on-one, but if you're relaying information about what another council member is going to say, it's a Brown Act violation.
So you're answering my question.
So you're getting into a deliberation, basically. It's considered out of meeting deliberations. And then you've got the hub and spoke. They call it the hub and spoke. A calls B or emails B. Then A says, calls C. A calls D. Basically, A is acting as kind of the hub and relaying information out. Again, it's only one-on-one communication. But if you're relaying what a third or a fourth or a fifth member has said or what their position might be, Brown Act violation.
Okay.
You can communicate about date, time, and matters to be placed on the agenda. Typically, that's all we limit it to. And I think there's times where we might call you guys and, hey, there's a need for a special meeting. Are you available at this date, this time? That's fine. We're not deliberating or talking about city business. But again, it creates kind of a slippery slope because you don't want to have inadvertent violations. Well, what's the issue we're going to be talking about? Oh, I don't want to have a meeting on that. I'm not interested in approving that. Well, okay. You know, already we know too much. We don't want to know what your position might be on that issue. We just want to know whether you're available on this date and time for this item. So, and that's typically, I think, the mayor and the city manager talk to set the agenda, and that's it. So. So let's get to some questions. We'll liven this thing up a little as much as we can. All right, so if a majority of the city council attends, which of the following is subject to the Brown Act? Chamber meeting, the mayor's son's wedding, or high school football game? Any of those subject to the Brown Act? If, let's say, three or more of you are there at the same time?
A chamber meeting?
Just based on this, none of them are. Unless, again, really? You're talking about agency business. Okay. You can all go to the football game, you know, as long as you're not, and you can all sit together if you want. as long as you're not talking about city business.
But if you're there, the majority's there, the Brown Act applies. It may not, if you don't talk about business, of course it won't apply, but since the majority is there, if we start talking about business, it does apply.
Then it's a violation. Right. But again, if you're not talking about city business, you're fine. There's no Brown Act violation. No, the fact that you're there together is not a problem, is the point.
That's subject to the Brown Act. I think the point is...
Oh, well, yeah.
Council members are always
subject to the Brown Act. If you're, yeah, you're not going to violate the Brown Act as long as you're not talking about city business, right? So second, let's do another one here. During a disruptive meeting, who may be excluded from the meeting? Disruptive people, non-residents, all attendees but the media. D is the right answer, actually. Disruptive people first get booted out. And if there's more disruption, then basically you can clear the room of everybody except the media. Now, if the media is causing the disruption too, they can be gone. So everybody could be gone. But you can't just exclude non-residents just because they're not citizens of Reedley. So, but disruptive people is the main point. And then you can actually clear the room if it's getting so disruptive that you can't even get through the agency's business on the agenda. Clear the room. You got to let the media in unless they're causing the disruption as well. We haven't gotten there. Hopefully we never will. Here's one of the questions earlier. Staff takes 90 minutes to testify in favor of an action. Can the public comment be limited to 3 minutes per speaker for a rebuttal? What do you think?
Yeah.
Answer is no. The answer is actually A. You can't limit it to 3 minutes per speaker. Now, again, the answer is really no, you can't. Now, again, but if you get to a point where you've got 50 people on the other side and it starts getting repetitive, then you could say, okay, we haven't heard anything new now from the last 10 speakers. Is there anyone that has anything new to add? But basically the idea is you got to give equal time to both sides, support or against.
Scott, I have a question on that.
Sure.
That statement says staff takes 90 minutes to testify in favor of an action. That assumes that that's a staff report necessarily and not part of the public comment. Public comment would come after that 90 minutes.
Right.
Right.
Well, and again, this is not the general 3-minute public comment portion at the beginning of the meeting, where they limit it to 3 minutes at the beginning on whatever item it might be.
Oh. Okay.
This, now we're talking about a specific. It's not as clear. We're talking about a specific agenda item. Let's say approval of an agreement or something.
These are all trick questions, Scott. That's what
well,
you're doing.
Yeah. They're not. They're designed to make you think. But yeah, the idea. This is for a specific agenda item. Now we're talking about a specific agenda item, and so that. The debate can go on and on. It's not going to be limited just to 3 minutes for a speaker. So the idea is, hey, equal time for both sides in that instance.
You know, I have a question now.
Sure.
Thank you, by the way. So let's say that during public comment period, public asks a darn good question, and then staff gets back up to address, and let's say it sparks another question of somebody who already gave public comment. Can they get back up to address what staff just said?
It's going to be up to the mayor to recognize that person if it's gone over the 3 minutes, really.
Interesting. Okay.
That's why typically we don't want to have too much back and forth during the public comment. Again, this is an item that's not on the agenda, so we don't want to have too much discussion. Council's not going to be able to take any action on that item anyways, whatever it is, because it's not on the agenda.
Well, and I always feel sorry for the staff because sometimes they don't know it's coming, and then it's like, you know,
right.
They don't have time to prepare to give a rebuttal.
Right.
So it's just, to me, I look at it as more public information, you know, and it'll be referred to the staff to develop further or to answer the questions.
Right. And if it's something that's that important, then could even have it put on the next meeting agenda or a future meeting agenda.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
What about if it's a notice of public hearing? That back and forth. Where?
That's fine. Yeah. If it's during a specific agenda item.
Yeah. You have to let them, if we respond to a comment, sparks question on another comment, you've got to let them say, I've got another comment.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And we've had that. Or you go back and, I mean, the public hearings can go on all night. again, as long as it's new information that's being shared. If once it starts getting repetitive, then you can ask, you know, and shut it down. But again, if it's going back and forth, and we've had those, we've had a couple that have gone back and forth for long hours. So
could the council at that point, at a reasonable time, say 11 o'clock, okay, this has gone on, okay, we're going to take this up again tomorrow evening.
You could adjourn. Yeah, you could adjourn in that situation.
Five days.
Yeah, if they want to do, I mean, you could even adjourn and re-agendize it or whatever, but you can adjourn to a date certain, date and time certain, as long as everybody knows and is gets notice of when that is going to be, when they're going to next open it back up and discuss it and deliberate it. Yeah.
Is that if you close it or leave it open? You leave it open?
Well, you wouldn't want to, you shouldn't close, if it's a public hearing, you shouldn't close the public hearing. You should leave the public hearing open, but adjourn it, leave it open, because otherwise then you have to reopen it. There are certain instances where you shouldn't reopen it. So leave, it's kind of tricky. You can adjourn the meeting, but leave the public hearing open. Mm-hmm.
To be continued.
Yeah, to be mm-hmm. continued, and then so you don't have to close it and reopen it. It's just for the record, basically. There's times where the record needs to be clear. There's been some questions on this, too, from even the council. The council, city manager, and staff relations. You guys all know the council sets the policy for the city, and the city manager and the staff go about implementing that policy according to your directions. Council members should address the issues with the city manager. You can certainly inquire of department heads or other staff, make inquiries of them, but you shouldn't be giving directions to a staff member. Talk to the city manager. The city manager is supposed to deal with the staff one-on-one or however that is. And the city manager, again, is supposed to take orders only from the council during a city council meeting, not from individual council members in her office or elsewhere. And that's right out of the Reedley Municipal Code, as you guys all know. So any questions on that or comments?
So when you start giving staff directions, now you're micromanaging.
Right.
Okay.
Let the city manager do that. That's what she's there for. So you know what, I have a little bit of stuff on the conflict of interest, and that's even more dry than the public Brown Act. So let's if you've got any questions before we get into that, and then I do have a few examples at the end, but this is a lot shorter. But this is just, again, you guys get training every 2 years on the conflict of interest stuff. This isn't designed to be a full-blown conflict of interest training, other than just to let you know about the issues so you can recognize them, and especially for Councilmember Beck. Since he's new and some of this is going to be new to him, obviously, just to make him aware of some of the issues. The Political Reform Act basically says you can't participate in a decision if you've got a financial interest that's going to be materially affected by that decision, whether it's going to be helped by that decision or hurt by that decision, whatever it might be. Maybe it's you're going to benefit financially from it or you're going to get hurt financially from it. Doesn't matter. The Political Reform Act of 74 is the one that governs this area. Basically, public officials, whether elected or appointed. So again, we've got both. We've got elected and appointed officials up here. Perform your duties in an impartial manner, free from bias caused by their own financial interests or financial interests of persons who have supported them. So again, the financial interests of your spouse is taken into account here as well. And the FPPC, or the Fair Political Practices Commission, is the agency that oversees these types of issues. They've got a website you can go to, and they've got a whole bunch of training materials and frequently asked questions and things like that where, you know, if you've got an issue and you want to see if maybe they've got a Q&A on there, you can certainly go there for a frequently asked question. You can contact me, city manager, city clerk. We can point you in the right direction or try and help you with whatever it might be. Form 700s, obviously, the city clerk required to get those out, and all the council members have to fill those out every year. So Mr. Beck will be filling one out if he hasn't already.
Completed it.
So there you go. Okay. The financial.
It didn't take but just a short time.
The financial disclosure, yeah. The financial disclosure statement, and that's a public record, so anyone can see it. Basically, the FPPC basically administers and enforces the Political Reform Act. Consultants are available, and I think I've mentioned this before, but even if you get written advice from me on a conflict of interest question, although, and I typically might not give written advice, and I frankly, I don't think I will give written advice to a specific council member. I'll give it to the entire council on an issue that might be raised, because advice from the city attorney or anybody else is not going to provide the council or the individual council member that may have the conflict with any sort of immunity. The only way that an individual council member can get immunity is to get a written advice letter from the FPPC, which is very rare indeed. So, again, you can ask for advice, and we'll give you the best advice we have, but our advice is going to be basically geared towards the council as a whole. What's going to protect the council as a whole? What's going to protect the council's decision the best? So we will advise, if it's clear that a council member has a conflict, then we're going to advise, you know, you shouldn't participate, because the whole decision of the council is going to be at risk just because one member has a conflict and refuses to step out. So again, we don't want the council's decision to be at risk, so we'll be advising the council basically as a whole, but not an individual council member.
On these conflict of issue questions, you know, we rely a lot on staff, and a lot of the decisions we make are based on staff information. So technically, we're the ones voting on these issues. And do any of these apply to, say, let's say, an unscrupulous staff member who's benefiting?
Some of them do, and I've got a slide on that. It's not as much as with the legislative body members, but there are instances where city employees are prohibited from participating in certain activities or entering into certain contracts, or the city's prohibited from entering into a contract that an employee might get a benefit from. Okay. So basically, in the context of contracts, for the decision makers like yourselves, it's not only contracts, and we'll get into that in a couple of slides, but it's any sort of decision, you know, a decision on approval of a project, basically. I mean, that could be something that you guys are conflicted out of, but staff might not necessarily be conflicted out of that. They're not ultimately making a decision on that issue. That's up to the city council to make that decision, or the planning commission can certainly be in your shoes as well. There's basically five types of economic interests that they look at. Business entities, so if you're an employee or in management, or if you have an investment. Real property, the 500-foot rule, I think that's typically the most common that maybe you guys are familiar with, and the ones that we see typically. But that applies to not only property owned, but property leased as well. The 500-foot rule, the presumption, the law presumes that you're going to have an economic interest in that. And so typically, if it's within 500 feet of property that you own or lease, then you're going to be conflicted out. We're going to say, hey, you shouldn't participate. You're within 500 feet.
And that happened with the Walmart issue. You had two council members that were within 500 feet, so they had to step aside and just left three council members to make the final decision.
Now, if there would have been a third that would have been conflicted out, then you could actually draw straws. So you'd only have two people that aren't conflicted. So you don't have a quorum to make a decision. In that instance, the law says you got to get enough people in there to be able to make a decision.
Right.
But you can't just pick and choose. So you could draw straws. Those three could draw straws, so one gets to come back in and help participate.
So we were never told about that one.
Yeah, you could draw straws.
Whoa.
You could get a third person back in so you can make a decision. Because otherwise, you can't. There could be instances you can imagine, even in small cities, especially real small cities. I mean, everybody's gonna, you know, the council may have the people that own most of the property in town or something. Nothing's gonna get done, you know, if it's basically three or four people conflicted out of every decision. So there are instances where you can get enough to make a decision, but again, it can't be the same person every time. Well, you know, Councilman Salino, you're always going to be the one back in on these issues. It's got to be random, basically selected randomly.
Flip a coin?
You can flip a coin, yeah. I don't know how you could flip a coin. You could Rochambeau, I guess. I don't know. You got to figure it out if it's three people, though. So you do round robin or something. So there's the five economic interests. So you've got the business interests. You've got the 500-foot rule, sources of income, and that includes employee, spouse. So again, your job, your occupation, that's an economic interest that you have. Source of gifts. The gift regulations change every couple of years. It used to be 390, now it's 420 is the gift limit. And you're required to report gifts as well. And that's a separate form that you'll have. And then personal financial interest, that's income, assets, liabilities, 250 or more. So those are the thresholds to determine whether you have an economic interest in a decision that may be coming before you to see whether or not you have a material economic interest and you're going to be conflicted out. Those are the threshold levels. Those five. So again, restating the rule, you have a conflict of interest with regard to a particular decision if it's likely that the outcome of the decision is going to have an important or material impact on your economic interest and a significant portion of your jurisdiction does not also feel the important impact. So again, let's talk about water rate increases or sewer rate increases or garbage rate or the general plan. Those are all things that you're going to have an economic interest in. But they apply equally across the board to everyone in the city. So you can participate in those decisions, you know. But other decisions where it's just geared towards you or maybe your spouse, then you're going to be conflicted out. So you're not conflicted out of those decisions that are impacting everyone in the city basically equally or of the same nature, maybe not equally in terms of dollars and cents. Maybe your rates as a residential customer is going up less than commercial rates, but nevertheless, the rates are going up. Or down, who knows, but typically it's up. So if you're disqualified, you can't participate. Not only can't you participate in the ultimate decision, but you shouldn't participate in any of the influence or, you know, whatever that might go on behind the scenes, whether with staff or other council members. You have to identify the nature of the conflict at a meeting, and we've had this before. Whoever it is would state what the conflict is and then step down from the dais and leave during the deliberations and consideration of that item. Now, you could speak as a member of the public if you wanted to, and I've seen that happen before. I don't know that any of you have done it, but it has happened before at other meetings. So, and it's allowed, and you can speak as a member of the public, but you can't participate in the deliberations as a council member. And the penalties, like I said before, the most important one really is the decision's invalidated. So the action that the council took is technically invalid. It's as if it never happened. Can be a misdemeanor for the particular council member that had the conflict, that participated, that shouldn't have participated. There can be fines. See in the media every once in a while, there's always people getting fined, it seems like, for some sort of conflict of interest. Typically it's at the state level, but there are local level officials that get dinged for conflict of interest violations as well. Maybe liable for paying attorney's fees for both yours, obviously, and the other side's, and then the embarrassment can be the worst thing, really, for some people. Now, here's the special rules for contracts, and we're getting almost to the end here. And this goes to the questions about employees. So this does apply to employees. So city officers, which you are officers, and employees cannot be financially interested in a contract made by them in their official capacity. So again, let's say we may have a department head that is authorized to enter into certain contracts, not get council approval. So they may have a threshold limit that they can go up to and spend up to. You can't go with, well, let's use landscapers or something. Let's say he has a landscaping business on the side, or his wife has a landscaping business, or the husband has a landscaping business and the wife is the department head. If he has the authority or she has the authority to go out and contract for that type of service without going for council approval, absolutely prohibited from going and contracting with that landscape company for those services if they have an interest in it or their spouse has an interest in it. Can't do it. And the penalties are even harsher than the other penalties, not necessarily for employees, but even city officials. So the same instance, let's say one of the city council members had a landscape business, and that's what you did. The city cannot contract with you, even if they go through a formal public bidding process, absolutely prohibited to contract with that company that the council member has an interest in. Can't do it, even if it's would otherwise be fair and it was a publicly bid out process. Can't do it, absolutely prohibited. And again, you can't even participate. Well, it's not even good enough in the normal conflict of interest situation where you state your conflict, get down from the dais, don't deliberate, don't participate in the decision. You can't even enter into the contract. Abstention would do no good. Even if you don't participate, it's not allowed. That's how strict that prohibition is. Both oral and written contracts, typically they're written contracts that we're dealing with, but you can't enter into the contract. The council is prohibited from entering into that contract. That's government code 1090, so if you hear 1090, that's a 1090 violation. You see that every once in a while, too. City of Bell was one. You heard everything in the City of Bell. There's very, very limited exceptions. Again, you're talking rule of necessity, which is, again, is going to be more of the small town stuff where, let's say, maybe they're the only ones that the council member's company or the city employee's company might be the only one that's providing that good or service in the local area. And that could be a limited circumstance where, okay, you can do it, but again, now you got to abstain. It's very limited, though, and I can't imagine really off the top of my head any that might apply to Reedley for a rule of necessity, just because there's so many goods and services around Reedley that it shouldn't be any that you guys might provide or one of the employees might have on the side that you have to go with them. The penalties, the contract is void and unenforceable, so you try and enter into it, it's void. It's as if it never happened. Actually, it's beneficial to the city, though, because the city gets to keep whatever the goods or services were and don't have to pay a dime to the other person. But the criminal and civil penalties, and with a conviction, if it's a council member, so public official as opposed to an employee, public official, you're barred from ever holding public office again. So pretty strict penalties for a 1090 violation. 1091s are the harsh ones. Just a general ethics principle. I like to kind of close with this. Trustworthiness, respect, fairness, and responsibility. You got Abe Lincoln there. Honest Abe. So the questions, when dealing with conflicts, you'd like to kind of think maybe big picture. You want to even avoid the appearance of impropriety. Consider how you're going to appear on the front page if it gets to that point. How do you want to be remembered, you know? Those are all big issues when you're dealing with conflicts. I think there's some review questions at the back. We can go through just a couple of them real briefly if you want. They're pretty quick. Let's see.
Scott, is there statute of limitations on Brown Act violations?
That's a good question. There probably is. I don't know what it is, though. Pretty short, I would think. Basically, the primary remedy for a Brown Act violation, if it's simply, you know, let's say it was an improper closed session or there's information that action was taken in closed session and wasn't reported out properly, or if it's in a normal meeting setting but something happened that was procedurally wrong, cure and correct is the remedy. Basically, you have to send a written notice to the city demanding that they cure and correct the violation if it happened in a meeting. So let's say, I don't know, the motion wasn't proper on an item that you took. So they say cure and correct it. So then we would go back, okay, was it really wrong? Then we go back and cure and correct it. So that's typically what's done. You're talking about like Brown Act violations where it wasn't in a normal meeting setting. That maybe, okay, we've got allegations that all five of the council members were meeting on a specific project and we're talking about how they're going to vote before they even get to the meeting. Then that's a whole different setting. You can't really cure and correct that. I mean, that's something that's outside of the normal meeting setting. The only thing you could do is you can't can't do it again. And if it gets to the DA, it could be prosecuted. So,
but generally,
I think it's 2 years, maybe.
Misdemeanor violations. I mean, there is a statute of limitations on those.
Yeah, none of these are felonies that I know of, except maybe a 1090. I think 1090 might be.
But I think
might be a felony.
In a situation where, let's say, there was a decision that was made, and that practice is still in place as a result of that decision, then I would think that if there would be no statute on that, that they, if somebody discovered it and brought it forward, then I think from that point
you mean
forward,
as far as invalidating the action or going exactly, back and correcting
and
it?
And I can't give you an example, but let's say that, you know, five council members 10 years ago did something that was a violation, and we're still utilizing that practice or buying from the same vendor or something like that. You know, I mean, I think that that can be invalidated.
Yeah. Well, with like the 1090, technically the contract, if it was entered into and it shouldn't have been, the contract is void. It's considered void, which is different than being voidable. So void means it never really even happened. Voidable means that if someone wants to challenge it and void it, then they can. But void means it never, it's as if it never really even existed. So if it's discovered, then you go back and say, hey, contract's done. We want all our money. The city wants all its money back because technically we shouldn't have been paying you all that money. That's why I say the city could actually benefit in that instance. You could recover all the money that you've paid for whatever service that you've gotten all those years. With respect to ordinances, there are limits on ordinances for challenging ordinances, depending on what the challenge might be. Typically, the ordinances, you have maybe 30 or 90 days to challenge the validity of an ordinance. So if there's a technical defect maybe in how the ordinance was done, you'd have to look and see exactly what the defect might be. But even if it was something that might arguably have been done maybe incorrectly, if it wasn't challenged within a certain period of time, the ordinance may still be valid, even if it's 10 years down the road.
Even if it's a Brown Act violation?
Well, it depends on what the violation might be. But there are instances where ordinances, you have only a certain limited period of time to challenge some type of ordinances. Limited period, so depends on what the violation might be.
About the, since it was, you know, it would apply the same if there was a violation that should have never happened, that it should be null and void. But you're saying that there's a statute.
It depends on what this. I mean, there could be any number of reasons. If it's procedural or if it's some other process that maybe the notice wasn't done correctly, but the adoption process by the city council was done correctly. There could be any number of challenges to it. Just depends on what it might be.
Okay.
More like a development proposal or a land use entitlement that's entitled but hasn't been built yet. Usually has a specified life subdivision now.
Mm-hmm.
If there were a Brown Act, kind of like there was a Brown Act violation over the approval of that map prior to it getting developed and built out, is that something that would be voided?
Could be. Yeah. Now, once, if the developer starts putting improvements into the ground, then there may be trouble. But if it's before the improvements start to get put in the ground, yeah, definitely. If someone wanted to challenge it, they could challenge it. We'd have to go back and look, and they could, someone could seek an injunction to get a court to order that no work happened until the issue was cleared up, as to whether there was any sort of shenanigans going on with the approval or whatever it might be. Any other questions? Let's do just a few review questions just to kind of highlight some of the issues. I think you've got them at the back, number one. So we're going over economic interest, source of income and business entity. Sarah's a planning commissioner in her private capacity. She works for Pride Employees, Inc. Her husband owns 100 shares of Technisoft valued at $50 a share. In which, if any, of the following business entities does Sarah have an economic interest? What's the best answer? C is the right answer. Obviously, she's got a business interest in Pride Employees because that's where she works. And she has an economic interest in Technisoft because she has the investment with her husband. Everybody clear on that? Two, Jim's a council member and an attorney. He and his wife own a single-family home. He leases office space for his law practice. He also owns 2 of the 10 limited partnership shares in a limited partnership and owns a downtown office building. What are Jim's economic interests? Does he have an economic interest in his home? Yes, obviously he does. Does he have an economic interest in the space he leases? Yes, again, economic interest in real property, whether it's owned or leased. Does he have an economic interest in the office building? Yes. His shares exceed, actually there's a threshold limit that we didn't touch on, but it's a 10% limit. So shares exceed 10% of the partnership. So he's deemed to have an economic interest. Three is a gift example. Eileen's a building inspector for the city. She's offered the opportunity to rent a Shaver Lake condo with Whack-A-Mole Development Company for its cost. Rather than the standard rental fee, Whack-A-Mole Company has several residential projects under construction in the city. Does the difference between the standard rental fee and the amount paid by Eileen constitute a gift?
It's a bribe.
Yeah, it's definitely a gift. The next issue is whether it's a reportable gift, but it's a gift because it's a discount that's not otherwise given to other members of the public. So the next question is it over the $420 threshold to make it a disqualifying gift, or over $50 to make it a reportable gift that you have to report at least but wouldn't otherwise get disqualified? So, but the issue is it's a gift. Gifts aren't always just wrapped in bows and free tickets and things, so it can be other discounts that you might otherwise get. We have a couple more. This is the 1090 example. Armando's the city manager. At a recent city council meeting, the council and Armando discussed recent IT problems encountered by the city and the benefits of contracting with a private vendor for certain services. Subsequently, the council approved Armando's proposal to solicit bids from vendors for the performance of such services. Did Armando participate in the making of a contract, which is the language directly out of 1090? What do you guys, anyone on the council care to venture?
I say no. I mean, isn't that part of his city manager job?
Well, he did participate in the making of the contract under the requirements or the language of 1090. That's considered participating. Now, it's not going to be problematic as long as he doesn't have an interest in the ultimate vendor selected. But if he has an interest in the ultimate vendor selected, then it's going to be prohibited. Not going to be able to enter that contract. But he did participate, just simply drafting the staff report and talking to council and sharing that information during a council meeting is considered participating in the making of the contract. So, but again, it's not a problem as long as the vendor that is ultimately selected is not one that Armando is affiliated with.
So are you saying our city manager can't help someone make a contract or set up a contract format or?
No. As long as it's not a company that she owns or has ownership in or
okay.
Her husband owns.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't get that piece of it here.
No, she,
okay.
The idea is to show you how broad the term participate in the making of a contract is.
Okay.
Even though it's not her ultimate authority or pointing at Nicole, it's Armando here, but the city manager ultimately has no authority to enter into that contract. It's the council that's doing it.
Right.
But the fact is that city manager participated in the making of that contract by bringing the proposal forward, bringing the idea forward, discussing it with council. Again, it's not a problem as long as the city manager doesn't have a financial interest in the company that's ultimately selected.
Okay.
I see what's going on here. Yeah. It's city attorneys can participate in making the contracts, right?
No.
But in the contracts, yeah.
No, city we're considered city officers too. So
Armando's Uncle Guido.
Uncle Guido is probably going to be okay because it's not unless they're somehow tied financially to it.
Unless they bring a contract too.
Well,
then yeah, you could have it.
It doesn't really go that far. You're talking about
an interest,
spouses and dependent family members. Basically, it doesn't really stretch that far to a distant niece or nephew or uncle or whoever it might be. That's where the appearance of impropriety comes in.
That's, I brought that
but,
up because I
yeah.
So yes,
yeah.
Yes,
the appearance of impropriety,
legal,
yeah.
It was shaky.
Yeah, that's where it's going to be shady. It's not going to be looked favorably upon. So the last one's just kind of a general fairness one, and this is kind of a common law bias type thing, just a fair hearing type issue. Sam's a council member. His neighbor is seeking a CUP for a nightclub in a neighborhood shopping center. It's more than 1,500 feet from his home, so forget about the 500-foot rule. We're clear there. Sam does not like his neighbor because of frequent late-night parties that he's never invited to. He also believes nightclubs should only be located downtown. So Sam, the council member, goes door-to-door in the neighborhood of the proposed nightclub to rally opposition to the nightclub. If it gets to council, may Sam participate at the council hearing to consider the CUP? Anybody going to guess? The answer is no. He shouldn't.
No. Yeah.
He should not participate. He's already clearly stated his bias against the project outside of the public meeting. So he's coming into the meeting without basically if it's so obvious that they've stated outside of a public meeting what their position is, then the person's not going to get a fair hearing for that CUP. That's the issue. So you need to be careful about what you say outside of a meeting if it's going to be an issue that's ultimately going to be coming to you for a decision, especially in the context of a hearing like for a CUP.
Could a council member encourage people from that neighborhood to come in?
I would prefer if a council member is going to do that, just say encourage the people to come forward to speak on the issue, not speak for a specific viewpoint. Don't encourage them to come and speak against it. Don't encourage them to come and speak for it. Just encourage them to come and speak about it.
Their opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if they were to say, hey, I'm encouraging you to come and speak against it, that's probably not enough. But if you're in a situation where they're going door to door, maybe they even show up at the Planning Commission meeting and speak against it, and then they're ultimately going to be considering it at the council level, then it's not going to be fair, really, for the other side if that person is now participating in that decision when they've clearly indicated their bias either for or against the project, whatever it might be.
You know, I agree they should recuse themselves, but there's no Brown Act violation here.
Correct.
There's, not good use of judgment, but it's not illegal, is it?
Well, it's not illegal in the sense that you're going to get or that the council member is going to get either civil or criminal penalties, but the decision could be overturned. There's cases out there that talk about the bias and the fair hearing issue, and the decision could be overturned, whatever the decision might have been. Maybe it was rejecting the CUP or approving the CUP, and whatever it might be. If that person who had clearly evidenced a bias before and outside of that public hearing participates in the decision could be invalidated if it gets challenged or from whoever, either the project proponent or maybe opponents against the project if it got approved. Yeah, David?
We had a subdivision in Reedley in the early 90s that was denied and we were taken to court and it was ruled that council members showed a bias prior to the public hearing against the project. So the project was then approved with just a minimal set of conditions, not the standard set of conditions that we would impose normally, and the subdivision was built where there's still now some public improvements that we bear responsibility for. So it's happened here that council members showed a bias prior to the public hearing.
One member or all?
I think it was two. I know it was at least one. But
it wouldn't matter, even if it's one. If it's one, I mean, obviously the advice would be don't participate because you're going to potentially risk the entire decision of the council. And as long as it's only one member that maybe has shown or gone above the line for showing what we would consider maybe too much bias, either for or against, we'd recommend that council member not participate so the other four can go ahead with the decision. And the decision would be fine at that point. No one could challenge it on a bias ground if that one council member or if it was two, if they don't participate.
Well, Scott, I mentioned before about the traffic problem in neighborhoods, and what I recommend to the people is that they sign a petition of all the homeowners and bring it, if they bring it to the city or to the police chief to take care of the problem, is that a problem with me?
Not at all.
But if it brings it to the council for a decision, then I would have to step down.
No.
No?
No, I mean, there's not a specific issue, I guess, at play there in that instance. It's just a general traffic concern.
All right.
It really would be, in the context of this example or even the one that David had spoke about, I mean, we have a specific project that's a defined project that's seeking entitlements or something right. of that nature.
Okay.
So you're speaking against or for a specific project as opposed to just a general issue of citywide concern.
Although, I would say that if it's a stop sign you were looking for right in front of your house or something like that, you might want to think twice about gathering petitions and support and all that, because it does seem that that would be a personal interest you would have there.
Okay. Good.
Any other questions?
If that council member, say, like the Planning Commission came and spoke against something that a Planning Commission for something that was going to be built, and they refused to step down.
You mean at a council meeting?
They came to the planning commission and spoke against a project,
mm-hmm.
and then they came and voted on it at the council meeting. If they were approached and refused to step down and not vote, is there anything could be done?
Well, if they're going to refuse, the mayor, let's say the mayor is asking them to step down, mm-hmm. city manager and the city attorney are advising them not to participate, and they refuse. Well, interesting question. I mean, I guess we could go forward with the vote and see which way they lie and see if it gets challenged. But just in the context of a meeting, I mean, there are instances where you can get an injunction to prevent a council member from participating. But again, you're talking about knowing weeks ahead of time to try and get that. That's a very drastic measure. But if it's the night of the council meeting, and everyone's talking to them and saying, don't participate. You've clearly evidenced a bias against or for the project. And they refuse. We put it on the record to the extent we can that, you know, he's been advised or she's been advised that the council believes that this person has a bias in favor or against the project. We've advised them not to participate. They're refusing. They're going to participate. We want it noted in the record. This is what we think, and then go forward with the decision. Hope that it's 4-1, so it doesn't matter, and go forward. Mm-hmm. That's probably the best you can do.
I have another question just going off of that. Suppose that person, the councilman, was just at the Planning Commission meeting and listened to the proceedings. There wouldn't be anything wrong with that.
Not at all.
So we could attend sure. a council commission meeting.
Definitely, yeah.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, the Fair Political Practices Commission has come out with rulings, though, that if you are in that meeting and you evidence any bias through either a grimace or a groan or a smile, they will consider that bias as well. So.
But it has to be on a specific issue. If I'm head of the local AA, and it's well known that I oppose drinking in any form, and someone wants to get a liquor license 500 feet from my drugstore, and I'm on the council, the fact that I am known to oppose alcohol, in this particular case, it wouldn't matter where the license is, but that 500 feet, does that make a specificity for me to recuse myself, as opposed to being a liquor license anywhere else in town?
Well, if it's within 500 feet, for sure you'd have to recuse yourself. That's the easy one. Yeah.
No matter what my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Right. If it's within 500 feet of your property. If it's outside 500 feet, you're not barred in and of itself by the 500-foot rule from participating, but the bias could become an issue. But I don't know. That's an interesting one. Someone in AA.
The bias is the actively going out.
Right.
And opposing the project.
Promoting
if
or opposing.
If there's a public
yeah.
hearing notice that there's something that everybody knows your opinion, as long as you're not out sharing your opinion and you sit up there and say, I'm here with an open mind to listen to the public hearing and I'll make my decision, and when that comes around, that's the That's the best you can do.
Even someone, in your example, a recovering alcoholic, let's say over the years they've always voted no for every CUP for a liquor store or any establishment that's going to serve alcohol. Unless they've indicated a bias outside of a meeting, as opposed to just indicating at every specific project that comes up why they're voting no, then I don't think it's a bias. Just because you've got a pattern of voting a certain way, I don't think that evidence is a bias if it's not outside of a meeting and you're not rallying support for or against it.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions?
I think the bottom line is we're entitled to our opinion, and as long as we don't get out in public and, you know, sign petitions and actively go against the project, I mean, I think, you know, we can't be afraid of, you know, people come up to us and talk to us all the time about issues, about problems. You know, we're not robots. And I just think that we just have to use common sense in these situations. We can't be afraid of lawsuits. I mean, just because somebody sued our city, you know, we can't. That's the reason we're here. That's the reason we got elected. People need to approach us and run problems by us all the time. And, yeah, we're going to have opinions about things. But we try to be fair and objective when we're here.
And that's all you can be. You're supposed to be fair and objective when you're up there ultimately making the decision, so.
We can't be afraid of people getting sued because that happens all the time.
Right. Any other questions? That's basically it. Just a few more final slides. You guys are always good, open and transparent. I had an example actually for the chief would like this one actually. There was a council meeting down in Southern California in the last year, and I didn't have the audio, but there was audio. I can't remember if it was the city manager or the city attorney leaned over and said, someone came up during public comment, some guy that always came up at every meeting and really never added much to the meeting apparently, but the city manager or the city attorney leaned over and said, I need to borrow the chief's gun. And it was in the audio, and of course it was on the internet after that, and the guy made a complaint about someone making a threat, but obviously he didn't hear it at the meeting, but just know that the recorder's always on. So the principals, it's a public's business. They trust a process that they can see. I think we do a good job of that in Reedley. The financial interest disclosures, you guys all know, you fill them out. I fill them out. City manager fills them out. When you assume office, so Mr. Beck just did his. Every year when you're in office, when you change the position, if you've got a different reporting obligation, different positions may have different reporting obligations. And then upon leaving office is a requirement too. And those are public records, again, as you guys know. And that's it. Any more questions? Went a little longer than I thought, but it was good discussion.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah. It's already over.
Okay, the next item is item 7, request by council members for future agenda items or reports of council member activities. I'll start with the Mayor Pro Tem.
Don't have anything.
No? Mr. Beck, you're new, so we'll let you pass tonight unless you have something to share.
Oh, I'm still trying to take in what he said. So.
Okay. Councilman Chavez?
I wanted an update on two projects, one at Columbia and Manning, where we're at with that piece of land there in the corner, where that project is. And I mean, you don't have to do it today. And then the other one is that El Monte Market project. I mean, I see that building vacant still. What's going on?
We'll get you some updates. Thank you.
I have another.
I attended a dinner a couple of weeks ago put on by California Consulting. They had invited Tom Torlakson, who is our California State Superintendent of Schools. And Mr. Torlakson, I had met previously at another visit when he came to Fresno, and he knew about Reedley and was really excited. Steve and I talked to him again about our Central Valley Transportation Center, and during the formal dinner, he gave Ron Hudson and I a chance to again speak about that transportation center. And Steve is promoting that as the East Side Southwest Transportation Yard. So if you know, any of you know, on the west side there's that central transportation yard, and that's kind of what he's promoting to do on the east side of the valley. And I think that's a really good model to follow. Also spoke with Joe Hernandez, who was also at that meeting, the superintendent of Dinuba Unified, and he seemed very interested in learning more about our transportation center. So I've given that information over to our city manager to maybe contact someone regarding that. Also talked with the superintendent of Clovis Unified. They have an interactive green center that they have built for kids to learn about green energy concepts, jobs, and different internet things. And I wondered if that might be something that we might be able to use on the vocational ed side of that center. So that was another idea I came out from that meeting. After the meeting, Daria Sassimi was also there, and he is a member of the State Transportation Commission up in Sacramento. So I spoke to him again about our transportation center, and he said that he had received the presentation on his little school bus, he called it, the little thumb drive. So I thought that was a neat idea that John had come up with to do that presentation. And he's also interested in hearing more about that center. And he also is a owner of Granville Homes and has done a lot of infill development type of things, lofts on top of offices, et cetera. And he said that he would like to give us a tour of the type of things he's done in Fresno. So that's another idea. Tom Torlakson is also interested in promoting online access and high-tech education to our high schools and our voc ed programs. And he spoke very highly of our transportation center as it's a group effort in working with many agencies. And he said that that's the type of programs he wants to promote for the state because it gives the best bang for the buck for the people of California. Also attended the fire department open house. Thank you, Jerry, for coordinating that. I enjoyed the evening with my grandchildren, and I thought this time I'm going to go by and talk to each one of the groups of folks that were from out of town, and I just personally thank them for coming, and they were all so excited to be there. It was really neat, and some of them said, well, we'd like to do this in our community. And I said, well, talk to Jerry about how he does it. So it's a creative thing, and it's a special evening to many, I think, of the local children that don't get to see those type of things, and they get to crawl in and out of engines and see fires and people tearing apart things, and so it was a lot of fun. And I'm sure your guys have fun with that too.
Thank you for attending.
And then this last Wednesday, I attended the Fresno Council of Governments, had a transportation forum, and they showed highlights of the transportation projects for Fresno County this last year, of which our roundabout was the project that was chosen for Reedley. And Noe Martinez, I thought he'd be here this evening, our engineer, was also a speaker at that event, and I asked him if he would try to get a copy of the slideshow, at least for the east side, and maybe at a future council meeting we can show that. Other things. Also spoke at Reilly College today. Dan Kilburn is the student government leader for the college, and his group was wanted ideas, Mrs. City Manager, to help the city and get involved, and a couple of them asked about the possibility of doing internships here. So I asked them to give me some their information and ideas of what type of things they were interested in. And when the program was over, the president asked if there was like a group project that we could do. And so I'll throw that out. I was thinking, as they were talking this evening about painting the poles, maybe that might be something. I mean, these are college kids. I think they'd be a little bit more responsible than high school kids with paint, but never know.
We definitely use them.
I think you might be able to come up with some ideas that they could do as a group. There were about 25 kids that are in leadership there at the college. So, and that's all that I had. Staff reports.
A couple things from your city manager here. On Thursday, the EDC is holding their annual luncheon. We received notice of this a little later than we normally do. We just got the tickets yesterday, as a matter of fact. But if anyone is interested in attending, Reilly was given a table of tickets. Valerie from the chamber will attend, as well as a few other business owners from Reilly. If any of the council members are interested in attending, we do have tickets. It's from 11:30 till usually 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in Fresno at the Convention Center. So please let me know, and we'll arrange that. The other thing I did want to report in on is the San Joaquin Valley Power Authority. Reilly is a member. We did hold a meeting this past week to talk about the fact that the governor did sign SB 790, which frees the way or clears the way on community choice aggregation. And as you may remember, this Reilly community was interested in that. Mm-hmm. And so the San Joaquin Valley Power Authority has no plans to move a CCA forward right now, but we are watching intently throughout the state to see what other CCAs may come about. Marin, as you know, has one of the only operating CCAs in the state, and they were very successful in making sure that the PG&E ballot measure against this type of association failed. And so we will be slowly, methodically moving forward and working on this, but there are no immediate intents to create a CCA for Reilly or for the Central Valley just yet. But we are starting to watch now that SB 790 has been signed. So, yeah. That's it. Thank you.
Any other staff? Okay. Are there any other staff reports? Not, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you for coming.